the 17th, and we're going to be continuing with chapter 1, discussing an overview of investment alternatives, and we'll try to buzz through it quickly. Now, if you have questions, don't hesitate to stop me, like what you said. And then we'll get started on risk versus return. Maybe finish up today, maybe not. But first, any questions? Any questions before we get started? Website, any questions? You're going to spend a lot of time on the website. Anybody got a good joke? No, I only have bad jokes. I only have... So nobody has a good joke?
YouTube.
YouTube.
There's a video that you should watch for YouTube.
Okay, after class. Okay. So did I tell you about the alligator that walked into the barn? How about the bear? See, I didn't tell you about the bear. This bear walks in the barn. Have you heard this one before?
Yeah.
You guys can yell out the punchline. So this bear, it's a bear. He walks into a bar, and he walks up to the bar, and he puts his big, long paws up on the bar and looks the bartender right in the eye and says, "I'd like a beer." And the bartender says, "Why the long pause?" You see, he said, "I'd like a beer." So why the long pause? No. Too much. You don't want too much of a good thing. It'll ruin everything. Because they get worse. You know, you expect them to get better, not going to get better. Okay. All right. So today we're going to we're still flying in our jet airplane looking down upon the investment landscape, and we're going to take a closer view. Again, we'll flip through it fairly quickly, but if you have questions, don't hesitate to stop me. Now, as we go through, we're going to want to go through this list. We're going to want to keep an eye on what we can reasonably expect from our investments over the long term, or maybe in the short term, and what kind of risk is involved. Because it turns out that return, measuring investment rewards, returns, are very straightforward. How much did you start with? How much did you end with? How long did it take you to get there? Now, there are two types of returns. The absolute dollar return, but we're not interested in that that much because it depends on how much you start with, right? What we're interested in is the total percentage return. We want to be able to see what kind of percent return we get on our money. It would depend on how much money we have, so that we are able to compare investment alternatives and see, okay, you know, I can do better here, but what are the risks involved? The problem with risk is that risk is difficult to measure. In fact, it's impossible to measure. There are many ways, and all of them are imperfect. The one popular measure that is mostly used, and we will discuss, is called standard deviation. Now, how many people have taken statistics? I'm sorry. Statistics. How many people have taken statistics? Nobody? Just one or two people? Don't go screaming, yelling into the night. You don't have to do any stats in here. It's all done for us. What? You dropped out of statistics? Yes, I don't blame you. Standard deviation, actually I took 3 semesters of statistics in undergrad, in my undergrad's math degree, and I concentrated in that, and then went out into the industry and worked with simulation. I had a blast, I loved it. But it's tricky. Standard deviation measures the volatility of an investment. In any given year, there's about a two-thirds chance that the return of an investment will be within one standard deviation of the historical average return, plus or minus, well, later, relax. Don't worry. If you don't understand what I'm talking about, don't worry about it. All you need to know is that the higher the standard deviation, the more volatile the investment, the greater the variance from the normal return. Okay, that's all you need to know, and we'll come back to that after we go through our overview of investments. And here they are. Here are the most popular investment alternatives. Equities. Now you see, you have to start using the term equity. Don't use the term stocks, okay, because that's for the commoners. We use the term equities and we sound like we know what we're doing. In actuality, stocks are really called common stocks. Huh? Fixed income securities, those are known as bonds, loans. Short-term investments, also known as cash. Mutual funds, investment company is the legal term. And because we're in an introduction to investments class, we're going to use investment company, so we sound like we know what we're talking about. But the only problem with that is if you use that in the general population, they'll go, huh? What is an investment company? You say mutual fund. You go, oh, why don't you say so? And then hybrid securities, the others, and derivatives, we will not spend that much time on, but they're important. Preferred stocks, convertible stocks, real estate, hard assets, physical assets, and then derivatives, options and futures. So let's take a look at stocks. Do you want to invest in stocks? Yeah? All right. Well, stocks are exciting, folks. Stocks are sexy. Stocks are dangerous. The real term that most people do not use is common stock. Now, doesn't that sound like something you don't want? Plain old common stocks? No. The term comes from the idea that the shareholders are shareholders in common. Every share has one vote, and you get to vote on what's going to happen with your corporation. And that's what they are, folks. Stocks represent ownership. You are part owner of that corporation. And big deal, huh? Why do I bother? Well, you get two wonderful things. Dividends, which we don't talk that much about, and what are called capital gains. Or capital losses. And these are the things that people mostly key on, right? Yep. If I'm going to buy a stock, I want it to go up, right? Yep. Yeah, well, we have to remember dividends. And we'll spend a lot of time on dividends because dividends don't lie. But another thing, have you taken Business 120? Anybody? Let me take an introduction to business. You learned about limited liability. If you have a small business, what's called a sole proprietorship, you and the business are one and the same. So if your business loses money, they're going to come after you. Whereas a corporation is a legal entity unto itself. And if you're a shareholder of that corporation, you are only limited to your investment. You can't lose more. You buy one share at $100, it goes to zero, that's it. They can't come after you and say, you know what, the corporation still owes money. You got to pony it up. Nope, they can't do that. Not legally. Now, it's called the corporate veil, and there are some instances where the feds have said, or the authorities have said, okay, you set up the corporation just to shield yourself, and they're able to pierce the corporate veil. But if you buy a bona fide company, you know, they were trying to make money and they lost, you're limited to only what you invested. Now, stocks range from moderately risky to high risk to speculative. In fact, we have a name for it. We call it volatility. Oh, yes. When you ask somebody, how did that stock turn out for you? Oh, it was very volatile. What does that mean? He lost his shirt, right? He lost a whole lot of money. You have to get going? Wrong place? Okay. So, over the long term, stocks have returned the best of returns. 8 to 10 to 12, but I tell people 8 to 10. I don't want to get people's their hopes up too high, so I tell them 8 to 10. But some have done a whole lot better. Some have done a whole lot worse. They should be considered a long-term investment, right? A long-term investment. And see, let's see what the definition was for 2008. Stocks are equity investment instruments designed to lose value. Yeah. Do you remember 2008? I do. Okay, how about fixed income securities, or what we normally use the term bonds? Fixed income, or just fixed. You hear people just say, are you in fixed assets? Yeah, I got my money in bonds. These are loans. So you see here, the stock investor is an owner, where the bond investor is a loaner. Not L-O-N-E-R, but L-O-A-N-E-R. And who do you send your money to? Well, if you're a corporation, a large corporation, or a state and local government, or the federal government, if you go down to Mission Federal Credit Union and say, hey, can I borrow $100 billion or $50 million? You go to your local bank? No. You You go to the mob? Yeah, the mob, the investment community. You go to China. You go to UK. You go to Mexico. Mexico, investors love to invest in the United States. And you say, hey, we're IBM, or we're the state of California, or the city of Chula Vista, or we're the federal government, and we need to borrow money. Will you lend it to us? And people say, well, all right, what am I going to get in return? What do you get in return when you lend your money?
Interest.
And a promise to repay the principal. Now, are either of those guaranteed by... Well, yes and no. I mean, either guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the entity that is lending the money. Do you trust Walmart to pay its bills?
Yes.
Do you trust the city of Chula Vista to pay its bills?
No.
Say yes. Come on. Do you trust the federal government? Definitely not, right? You know, all the machinations in Washington aside, folks, the federal government will pay its bills, okay? Just no matter what anybody says. Now, they might have a crash course in and how to default. But no, the federal government's going to pay its bills. And the bond investors receive the interest and a promise that the loan will be repaid when due. Do most people pay their credit card debts and their car loans and their mortgages?
Yes.
Yes, they do. During normal times. Are these normal times? No. Yeah, it's a very different... We're coming out of it, but still. So in return for that less risk... Are we going to get more reward or less reward? That's the key, folks. Bonds are far less volatile, far less risky than stocks. So we should expect less investment return. There's no way to get around that. If anybody tells you differently, folks, they're just lying. They're not telling you the truth. And it turns out that corporate bonds... You know, pay 7%, 6%, 7%, 8%. Municipal bonds, meaning state and local governments and the Treasury government bonds, they pay 4% or 5% over the long term. Now they're paying a whole lot less. And why is that? Why would municipalities and Treasury bonds pay less than corporate bonds?
Less risk.
Less risk. It's that simple. Is the state of California going bankrupt? No, it's actually on the rebound, believe it or not. And we may actually have more classes in the fall. I doubt it. But maybe a year from the fall, we'll be back to maybe close to normal. I can't tell you how hard it is to email and talk to students and just say, sorry, the classes are full. I can't. I got 20 people on my 20. Well, I let 7 in. I got 27 people, 20 left on my one Business 121 online class, and they keep sending me more emails. Do you have any room in the class? No, now you're 21st on the list. I'm sorry?
It's a dollar.
2008 definition, bonds are fixed rate investment instruments designed to lose value. Yeah. Okay. Now, what about short-term investments? Short-term investments are often called cash instruments, cash investments, short-term vehicles. The idea is we need a place to park our money a year, maybe less, maybe a little bit more, depending on how important the goal for this money or what we're going to do with this money. They're usually guaranteed or pretty darn close. They're very liquid, which means often you can just write a check or just go online and transfer it into your checking account. Hence, less risk. Everyone should say, the people in the cheap seats, less risk, less reward, less return, less interest. Either all those names mean the same thing. So cash instruments, even though they are guaranteed, or because they are guaranteed, are going to wind up paying us anywhere from 2 to 4 to 5%. Now, what are they paying now? 0.01, 0.1, maybe you're lucky to get 1%. So we'll also discuss an emergency fund. We have a slide, but that's Tuesday. Since this is 2008, short-term investments are instruments designed to accept what remains of investors' money after they have given up on stock and bonds. After they lost 30, 40, 50%. Put it all in the money market. Put it all in the bank. Is that a good move?
No,
the market's been up 100% since then. Here are some examples, and we will discuss these more later in the end of the presentation on Tuesday, end of chapter 1. Deposit accounts at banks and credit unions, savings bonds, treasury bills, CDs, money market accounts and mutual funds, and commercial paper and bankers. It's later Tuesday. Okay. Now, mutual funds. Folks, the investments for the masses. The legal term that I prefer, but you know, you're just going to confuse people if you use it, is investment company. Ah, you want shoes? Where do you go? You go to Foot Locker. You go to a shoe company. You want a car? You go to a car company. You want investments? You go to an investment company. I like that term better. It's a vehicle where investors pool their money together to get two wonderful things that by themselves really they may or may not be able to do, and that is diversification and professional money management. And we will spend 2 weeks on these things, folks, because chances are very high that you will be dealing with these in an employer-sponsored plan, retirement plan where you work, 401k, 403b, those kind of things, pension plan. And so you need to understand these, as I will scream and holler later on. Very popular form of investment, and you have to be careful because not all mutual funds are the same. They range from very, very low risk money market mutual funds to extremely high risk. And let's see the 2008 definition. Yeah, them too, right? And here, I am so proud of this. I did this myself. Aren't you proud of me? I forgot the ABCDs. I forgot the ABCDs, darn it. Here we are. We're the little people. And we give our $50, $100 a month, more if we can afford it, to the people in the top hats. Right? The Wall Streeters, right? And notice more and more of them are women. Why? Why? Does your ear sticking up? Because women, turns out, they make better investors. Women make better... It's already been shown statistically. Yeah. Yeah. Why? We'll talk about that later on. What? Exactly. They don't treat it like a football game or a baseball game where they try to throw the Hail Mary pass or hit the home run, right? They're into singles. We use sports analogies often in investing. They're not perfect, but there's a little bit of truth to them, definitely, I think. To me, it seems that way. And you see, they create a pool of money. And there are millions of people putting billions of dollars away, so... These things are huge. And then they go out and buy the stocks for you. They go out and buy the bonds for you or the cash short-term instruments. And if they buy stocks, it's called a stock mutual fund. If they buy bonds, it's called a bond mutual fund. And notice, they might buy both. That's called a balance. We begin to see the explosion in the mutual fund industry by seeing the balance fund. And if they buy the money market, they buy the short-term investments, we call that a money market mutual fund. But often the mutual fund disappears and people just say, money market. Got your money in this market? No, I'm not stocks. No, bonds, no. I got it in the money market. Approximately 50% of American households own mutual funds, or used to. It's down to about 46% or so. Now, hybrids. Folks, before we continue, these four... are what we're going to concentrate on. We're going to spend the vast majority of our time... Actually, this guy, we only do one lecture. This guy, we get him out of the way because he's not really important. I shouldn't say he's not important. It's not difficult. There's no nuances regarding these. But these three, stocks, bonds, mutual fund, will be the bulk of what we study. Now, hybrid securities, hybrid investments. What does hybrid mean? A mix. Somebody ever hear the cheap seats? What does hybrid mean? A mix. And so the idea was to mix the advantages of stocks, ownership, and the advantages of bonds, the fixed income that you received, and the promise to repay the principal. They are designed to offer the stability of fixed income investments, bonds, with the opportunity for capital growth of equity investments. The problem with that is if you try to get the advantages of both, what do you often wind up with? The disadvantages of both. So it's the best of both worlds and the worst of both worlds. They're not that big a universe in the investing universe. They're not that big a piece of the pie to begin with. So we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on them. All I want you to remember now is that they're a mixture, an idea. And if you want to remember some examples, two examples are preferred stock and convertible securities. Now, doesn't it sound like you want preferred stock?
I want it because it's preferred.
No, you don't. You as an individual investor, me as an individual investor, thank you very much. We don't want them. It turns out that corporations want them. And there are certain tax reasons that we'll discuss way at the end of the semester. Other popular investment in vehicles, real estate. Do you want to buy real estate?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's a great time. It's not as good as it was the last couple of years. Last few months, things have changed. But, oh boy, real estate, I think, right now is still a pretty darn good deal, especially with interest rates so low. And we'll spend 1, maybe 2 days on real estate, precious metals, jewels and collectibles, tax advantage instruments such as low-income housing process, oil and gas limited partnerships. If there is sufficient time and interest, we will look at some or all of these, especially real estate and tangible assets. By the way, none of these were spared in 2008. All fall down. You know, people used to say, because they knew I was heavily invested in stocks, they'd say, well, aren't you sad about what's going on? I said, well, it's so fun to lose 40, 50% of your investment. But the real estate investors lost everything. And then some. Many are still underwater. Negative equity. Have you heard those terms? No? Well, they bought a condo for $320,000 in San Ysidro in 2006, which in 2000 was worth 80 grand, expecting it to triple in the next, 10, 12, wrong. It's now worth 130, 140, and they still owe $290,000 on it. What? $530, and now it's worth $300. Another casualty of the housing bubble. And then lastly, folks, I want you to know that these exist, and I want you to be able to say something along the lines of what you see here. That's all I want you to know. Derivative assets, derivative investments, are speculative. What's the word speculative? What does it mean?
Gambling.
Gambling. That derive their value from an underlying security or asset. And the examples include options and contracts. I'm sorry, options, contracts, and futures contracts. Where am I? Or just options and futures. It's hard to say options contracts and futures contracts. The book goes into very much detail on these in Chapter 3, and I really wish you wouldn't do that because I don't want you to. Many in the financial world, and I'm included in this group, do not categorize these investments. They are speculations, which is a fancy word for gambling. And the derivative speculators did not feel so all alone in 2008. Usually they're the only ones who are proud to have only lost 30%. They say, hey, you guys lost 30%? Cool, 30 weeks. So our emphasis, as I've already pointed out, will be stocks. We'll spend 5, 6 weeks, 7 weeks on stocks alone. Fixed income securities, bonds, a couple weeks on those, 2, 3 weeks. Short-term securities, one day, get them out of the way, they're pretty straightforward. And then mutual funds, we'll spend a couple of weeks on those. For the vast majority of investors, this is here. These are the most popular and most important financial options, investment options. Okay? Cool? With me? That's all I want you to know. Chapter 3 does the same thing, an overview of the securities. but goes into far more detail. So go ahead, read it. You know, don't. I'm not trying to tell you don't read it. But if you start seeing, you know, your head starts to explode or your eyes glaze over, or you go, "What is he talking?" Then just close the book. All right. Now, I forgot to bring the ABCDs. I have these little cards that I use, but I'll bring them next week. What are investment companies that pool investors' money and invest in a diversified portfolio of security? Investors get diversification and professional money management?
Mutual funds.
Mutual funds. D. Does that sound like a definition you could paraphrase, or if you want to, memorize it? But if I call you up at 2 o'clock in the morning and out of a deep sleep and say, "What's a mutual fund?" It's a pool of money that investors invest in and get diversification and professional money management. Okay? That will be all you need to say. Are you with me?
Yeah.
But you got to be able to do it. Because if somebody asks you, "Well, what is a mutual fund?" You're taking that Business 123 class and you can't give them a 2 or 3 sentence description. You don't have to go into detail. Then I'm going to look bad. You understand?
Yeah.
And we can't have that. Okay, because I need more students next semester. You're going to go out there and tell them how good a class it was. Now, yes, investment company is the legal term, which you won't hear unless you're in the industry. Mutual fund is the popular term. All right, what are investments that represent ownership in a corporation? Investors receive dividends and capital gains or capital losses. Stocks, right. When people use the term stocks, they are almost always talking about common stocks, but we just don't even use the term common stocks. We just say stocks. Now, what are investments with very little risk and correspondingly very little return, often used as a place to park your money or for an emergency fund of 3 to 6 months short-term security? Cash is another term. You just say cash, but it's not really cash, but it's the same as cash. Low risk, low return. And what are fixed income securities that represents loans to corporations, municipalities, state and local governments, agencies, and the federal government? Investors receive interest and a promise to repay?
Bonds.
Right, bonds. Fixed income securities. Because you know what you're going to get back. You know you're going to get 6% interest, and at the end of the term, you're going to get your money back. Providing the world doesn't fall apart, which it might. And what are securities designed to offer? The stability of fixed income investments with the opportunity for capital growth of equity investments. Examples include preferred stock and convertible bonds.
Hybrid.
Mixed. The best of both worlds and the worst of both worlds. And what are speculative securities that derive their value from an underlying security or asset? Examples include options and futures. Everyone just say derivatives?
Derivatives.
Are you going to stay away from these things?
Yeah.
Good. Smart. Move. Wait till we get to actually understand these things. You can make a lot of money. You can lose a lot of money. Options. Options and futures are examples. Now, do you want me to explain what an option and future is?
Not
now. We don't have enough time. But all you have to know is it's gambling. That is what it is, folks. You are gambling that the price is going to go up or down in the next few days, weeks, months.
It's like
yeah, it's like going to the crap table, pulling the levers. They're almost guaranteed to lose. Almost guaranteed to lose. You might win. Good luck. Dominus Sanctus. What are reasonable long-term expectations of returns from the following investments? Stocks? What do you tell? Quiet. What do you tell people?
8 to 10.
But we know better. We know that some of them have done better. But tell people 8, 9, 10. What are bonds?
4, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah. 4 to 5, 6 for treasuries, munis. 6, 7, 8 for corporates. Less now. What are short-term securities? 0.01. Right. 2 to 5. Mutual funds. Yeah, you don't know because you have to look at the mutual fund itself. You have to see if it tracks one of these three. How about hybrid securities?
No.
And what about derivatives?
No.
Negative. You're almost bound to lose. So what do you think, folks?
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Pretty cool? Did I go too fast?
I hope not.
Now let's look at investment returns and risks in detail. Investment return. Over the long term, folks, equities, stocks have produced the best returns. As we said, we tell people 8, 9, 10%, and if we do better, great. And if I get 8%, I'm a very happy man. Anything else is gravy. Fixed income securities, bonds, 4 to 6, treasuries, corporate, 6 to 8, paying far less now. Short-term investments paying far less now, and mutual funds were more or less, often less, reflect the underlying investments that they put their money into. Here is a graph from the sixth edition that shows how well inflation, treasury bills, long-term government bonds, and large cap, large company stocks and small company stocks. Now, what I want you to do is simply ignore the small company stock data. Okay, it's going to look really, really good. There's a serious problem, and even the companies that track small companies will tell you. There's a serious problem with trying to figure out how small companies are doing. The problem is called survivorship bias. Every big company used to be a small company, right?
Yeah.
At one time. But for every one Google, there are a dozen... Lycos, Alta Vista, Dogpile, Go, Ask Jeeves. You remember all those?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
You got a better memory than I do. Okay. So the small companies that disappear are, you know, thrown away. And so the data looks much better than it really is. So ignore the small companies. But look, folks, a buck back in 1929. Now, this includes the Great Depression. Look at the Depression, and then the go-go 50s and 60s, and then the 70s, and then the go-go 80, 90, 2000, and then... And it doesn't look like much, does it? What's the problem? That's a logarithmic scale. It doesn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It goes 10, 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, 10. But still... Which has done the best? Ignoring small company stocks, which has done the best? Stocks have clobbered everything else, haven't they?
Yeah.
Really clobbered everything else. But you had to put up with the volatility. You had to put up with the fact that if I'm used, it ain't going to be good. The treasury bills, which are a short-term security, have basically done better than inflation, but not much. And bonds have done all right. And now here's one that goes back even farther and includes gold. Don't you want to invest in gold?
No.
Yeah? No. Unless you believe that the world is going to end.
What?
Well, because gold will do really well. If the world ends, gold will do really well. But you better get yourself out of the northern hemisphere. Go down to Tierra del Fuego or Tasmania. Learn to raise goats and chickens. And
what about silver?
Silver will do, you know, it'll follow gold and other precious metals, although at a much lower price, because there's a whole lot more of it. But again, look at how well stocks have done relative to everything else. And notice when gold does well, when people believe the world is going to end. Civil War, right? 1930s. Depression, 1940s, and then 70s, what happened is inflation took hold in the United States, which is an unusual, it was high, it was 8, 9, 10%, which you guys have never lived through, most of you. And so gold spiked in 1981, and I remember, I was, well, I forget how old, I'm 24, something like 23, and I remember people lines around the block, because gold hit $100 an ounce, and people were cashing in whatever gold they had. And then look at what gold did for the next 20 years. And then it spiked in the last 10 years. But still, what? I'm sorry? I don't know. I think so, but it doesn't mean I'm right.
They don't have a gold in the United States.
I'm sorry?
I heard they say they don't have to lose gold because they need it.
No country uses gold to back their currency. Not anymore. The last country to do that was Switzerland back in the 70s. Yeah, but you really couldn't, even though it said you could. What do you mean it's worth nothing? Okay. Here's what you do. I'll bring you a bag, right? Okay, a bag with my name on it. You go to the bank and pull out all those worthless pieces of paper and put them in the bag, and I'll take it. Okay? Yeah, okay? Now, it is no accident, dear students, it is no accident that stocks and bonds have produced better returns than short-term investments. Otherwise, why would investors assume the higher risk of stocks and bonds? If you could get the same return from short-term securities and not have to deal with people not paying the interest or stocks going down 40-50%, which they do every once in a while, why wouldn't you just put all your money in the bank, right? To get a better rate of return, you're going to have to take some risk. There's no other way around it. Why wouldn't they, if they could, just assume what's called the risk-free rate of return? Now, the risk-free rate of return means I'm not worried about losing my money. And what they use, typically, not always, what they use is the return on, I didn't add it, 3-month treasury bills. And that's part of your first chapter assignment, is to go look at treasurydirect.gov and treasury bills and how well they're doing. So if I could get as good a return from my short-term securities as stocks or bonds, that's where I would put them. But that doesn't work that way. We know it doesn't work that way. And so what we're looking for is a risk premium. It's the reward for bearing risk. The extra return on a risky asset over the risk-free rate of return. And what we find is that, again, ignore the small company stocks, but large company stocks have returned, on average, about 8% better than the risk-free rate of return. The risk-free rate of return since 1925 for treasury bonds has been 3.8%, which is a little bit more than the inflation rate. But stocks have returned almost 12%. Now, don't tell people that. What do you tell them? Everyone say 8 to 10. Yeah, good. Okay. And long-term corporate bonds have returned 6.5%, which is about 3% better than treasury bills. About 3% better than inflation. And then government bonds, a little bit less. Are you with me? Understand? More risk, more return. We expect more return. Is it guaranteed? No, it's not. Risk versus return. Risk versus reward. Investment return is very straightforward to measure. We said that already. How much did you start with? How much did you end with? How long did it take you to get there? But measuring how much risk you took to receive that return is much more difficult. Each year, the investment community measures the average annual return and the amount of variance from the average return. Using statistics, which you don't have to do, it's already done for us, the resulting measures of risk are called variance and standard deviation. Hi! Do you have to do this? I just said no, right? Okay. We will leave the calculations for your statistics class. The book is going to teach you how to do it and wants you to do it. I'm not going to ask you to do it. You just look it up. It's online. Suffice to say that the higher the variance and standard deviation, the riskier the investment. The higher the variance and standard deviation, the more the investment return will deviate from the average annual return. Do you understand? No? Well, we said that we're going to get 8, 9, 10% from stocks. But in any one year, is it ever 8, 9, 10%?
No.
Very rarely. It's 22, minus 17, 4, 11, minus 12. Are you with me? Variance. Whereas these, very little. The standard deviation is narrower. So what does this mean? I know it's math, but it's really not that difficult. You take the return for every year that you measure, and you subtract it from the average return. That's what the bar means, average. You know how to compute the average, right? You add up all the numbers, you divide by a number, and that's it. Like the average you're used to. And then you square it. Why do you square it? It takes away all the negative signs. Because if you didn't square it, the pluses and the minuses would cancel each other out. So you square the two, and then that symbol means summation, sigma. It's been used for hundreds of years by mathematicians to say add. And then you divide that by the number of items minus one. Why minus one? You learn that in a graduate level statistics class. It's called the central limit theorem. And that is the variance. Then to get it back to a measurement that we're used to, you take the square root of that. That's the standard deviation. And what this is, folks, is just a fancy way of saying you can lose your money. That's just a fancy way of saying it. This should look familiar to you. What this graph is showing you for each year from 1926 to 2012 is where the average return for stocks, in this case large company stocks, has fallen. If it was between 0 and 10, we put the year there. If it was between 20 and 30, we put the year there. Notice that 2012 was a pretty good year, up about 13%. 2008, not so good. 1937, 1931, 1930, 2002. Does this look familiar?
Yeah.
Everyone should say yes. Wait till I ask you, what does this look familiar? What's it called? The bell curve. The normal curve. The normal distribution. And this is what we meant when we said back in the very first slide, or second slide, we should be about two-thirds chance of hitting one standard plus or minus one standard deviation. If we say that the average annual return for large company stocks has been 11.7%, that, and then say that the standard deviation is about plus or minus 15%, there's a two-thirds chance, actually I think it's like 68%, yeah, 68%, there it is, which is close enough to 66%, that the actual return will fall in here. Is it a guarantee? No, because there's a 95% chance, right, 95% chance that it'll fall two standard deviations away. And there's a 99% chance that it'll fall three standard deviations away. Which means one in 100, it's going to fall outside of there. Are you with me? And because it fell outside of there one out of 100 years, does it guarantee that next year it won't do it again? No, it's statistics. They call it the black swan. Have you heard that? When something completely out, just unexpected happens. But we know from statistics it's going to happen. It's going to happen. So are you with me? Understand? Or where, did I lose you? That's when you go like this. What? Go like this. Let me do like this. Go ahead. All right. I tell you that the average return is 11.7%. And you say, cool. And then next year you get minus 30%. And you come back to me and say, well, wait a minute. You told me it was 11.7%. I said, told you the average is. But in any one year, are you guaranteed to get the average? No, especially if the standard deviation is wide, as it is with stocks. And that's all we're saying. What we're saying is, sure, over the long term, you're going to get 8, 9, 10%, providing the world doesn't end. But in any one year, you don't know how much you're going to get. It might be positive, it might be negative. And the wider the standard deviation, the wider the standard deviation, the more chance it's going to be way away from the average. Does that make sense now? Maybe not. If not, stick around. I'll be happy to go over it again. And these graphs are not perfect. They're from the book. But what they're doing is they're showing the same, you know, size. When in reality, no. These are much smaller because they're spread out wider. These are much taller because they're narrower. But as we go down from the highest risk to the least risk, you see them getting closer and closer to one another. You understand? Up here, again, ignore small company stocks. Up here, there's a wide distribution. Down here, it's a very narrow distribution. And notice it, you know, it doesn't go below 0% because it's inflation. It always goes, well, at least it always has. Anybody questions now? Let's continue. Another view, not only if you don't like this, this is from the book. If you don't like it, don't use it. But the idea is the higher the standard deviation, the higher the rate of return, and the higher the risk. Now, we're measuring risk by standard... Come on, there's plenty of room. There's some people seated over there. We're measuring risk by standard deviation. But what did we say was the definition of risk? How do you define risk?
What you're willing to do.
Yeah, harm. Danger. So is standard deviation really a good measurement of that? Not really. But it's trying to show you that, yeah, you better be prepared. That's all it's trying to show you. You better be prepared. So, do you remember this slide from Tuesday? We showed you that Sweden trounced the United States. Well, I don't trounce. I mean, that's a pretty big difference. Trounced the United States and Canada. But when we add the standard deviation, who had the best risk-adjusted return? Who had the best risk-adjusted return? There's a reason why our capital markets are sought for throughout the world. Because sure, you got a better return from Sweden, but you had to accept 60% more risk. Their standard deviation, as measured by standard deviation, their standard deviation was 25%. Ours was 15, the lowest in the developed world. Are you with me? Understand? That's why the United States is still considered the most popular, the riskiest, the least riskiest, not riskiest, the least riskiest of the capital markets. Yeah! Okay. So, folks, does he's got it yet? Use once highs returns, you're going to get highs risk. You're going to lose some of your money. Maybe all of your money. And if anybody tells you differently, they're lying. And they will. So when, not if, you see an advertisement for a 12% safe rate of return. Bull, that's right. You will know that your chances of losing your money are pretty high, or else it's for 3 months, and then it goes down to 2%. When you see claims such as 300% or inflation, didn't we see that just today? Some of you were here before. Didn't we see that on Yahoo?
Yeah.
I can't believe Yahoo accepts those advertisements. They know these people are lying. 3,000%. And if you get involved in investing, you're going to wind up on these mailing lists. You're going to wind up on these email lists. You're going to get these things in the mail. You're going to get these things in the email. You sit on your hands, folks, and grab your wallet because you know that it's a scam. And by the way, they are breaking the law. Who is responsible for investigating and regulating this type of activity? The Securities and Exchange Commission. They are woefully undermanned, underwoman, whatever. Well, you might say, well, wait a minute, this is America, we have free speech, right?
Yeah.
Wrong. We have free speech in many arenas, but in other arenas, no. In the financial world, the speech is highly regulated. Before you can say certain things, you have to have them vetted, means it has to be reviewed, by not only your supervisor if you're a broker, but also by the company and the Securities and Exchange Commission. Well, actually, they don't do it. Another organization called Financial Industry Regulatory Authority does it on behalf of the Securities and Exchange Commission. So when people make claims of 300% or 3,000%, they are breaking the law. Now, what does the SEC do?
Nothing.
Not quite nothing. They send them a letter saying, stop it. A cease and... I kid you not. They send them a letter saying, cease and desist. And then the people keep doing it, and they send them another letter. Then they finally take him to court. This guy, Wade Cook, for almost 20 years, was telling people, if you're not getting 20% a month, you need to follow my instructions. Take our 3-day course. It's only $2,995. Do you believe me? It's true. This is what's going on. And if you go look at WadeCook.com, it'll say, oh, we're out of business. But we have another company called such and such and such and such. And if you want to take classes from us there, go to this website. Yeah. What did P.T. Barnum say? Anybody know? There's a sucker born every minute. And these people are counting on you to be a sucker. You want to take a look at one? We have time? I think we have time. On my website, I have a few. Here is turn $33,000 into $7,000 and $7 million in just 2 years. Yes! look, trade like a pro. Learn the trends that Michael Parnas used to turn $33,000 into $7 million in only 2 years. Free book and DVD, Trend Trading to Win, only $6.95. Now, wait a minute. If somebody, if you actually knew how to do this, would you tell anybody else?
No.
He can do it because he's bald. That's the only reason. But I figured out just how well he was doing, folks, to pull this off, he would have to do only 25% per month. 25% per month, and you can turn $33,000 into $7 million. So, do you see 25% per month up here? Hey, if you want to go look at Mr. Parnas and how he can do that, my power to you, but all I know is it ain't going to happen. You may say, but isn't somebody doing it? Isn't somebody making tremendous rates of return? It's true. There are people who can do it. Some people do make eye-popping returns. But are those people investors? No. Those people are... Everyone should say it. Those people are
traders.
Not traitor, but trader. Another term for them is, I want everybody to say it. They are called traders or, and when they may think I'm crazy, you may be right, but when you say it, it changes different parts of your body than when you see it and then when you write it. So these people are, or are you going to try that? Maybe. Maybe you will. And I will wish you good luck, and I will show you some examples of what goes on. But being a trader can be very profitable. The problem is that it's also very stressful and very perilous. And you are up against the best in the world. So first we're going to take a look at an interview from January 2009 when the markets were in turmoil. And it's by, where did it go? There it is. It's Steve Forbes, who inherited the Forbes magazine and Fortune. I liked his father. He's a bozo. His father had the best saying, once you've made it, you've had it. I love that saying. So my wife and I look at each other. Once you've made it, you've had it. Jose, would you turn the lights up? Okay, now... you can listen to the whole interview here, but what I want you to do is take a look at this one. Emotion is the enemy. And Mr. Bogle is the guy who made Vanguard what it is. So he knows what he's retired now and speaks to many people, but he knows what he speaks.
How do you get people to realize their emotions are their enemy? When the market goes up, is it too late to get in? Yeah, they take that necessary risk. The market goes down. Is it too late to get out? Yeah. How do you get people to overcome those? Now, the first thing you have to think about is, and this is an issue that I almost never heard discussed.
I see this
is about you have to ask yourself, am I an investor or am I a speculator? And an investor is one of the person who owns business and holds it forever and enjoys the returns that U.S. businesses and to some extent global businesses have earned since the beginning of time. They have capital. They're going to return their capital, and that capital grows over time. It's not complicated. That's the business of investing. Speculation is betting on price. I think I can buy this for 10 and sell it for 12 or 14 or 20 or 100. Speculation has no place in the portfolio or the pool of the principal investor. Speculation leads you a long way. It allows you to put your emotions first, where investment gets emotions out of the picture. You own these businesses, they're still sound. If the market doesn't think they're worth as much as they were, well, pity, the market doesn't know everything.
I love that. Pity, the market doesn't know everything. So, do you understand what he said?
Yeah.
Are you going to be an investor or are you going to be a speculator? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So when you say you're going to do both, take 90% of your money and invest it. Take 10% of your money and speculate and trade. But what I would recommend is go to Vegas.
Yeah.
It's a whole lot more fun. You know, they got the skimpy little girls in the light. I like the lights. That's the best part. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Trade currency and things that they're aware about.
You mean for it?
Foreign exchanges. Yeah, you know, all I can say is good luck. Because it ain't easy. And here's what you're up against. Here's who you are up against. John Merriweather. Now, this is a little story, we have enough time, that illustrates the kind of people you're up against when you enter this world. And again, I use the sports analogy, but I don't know if it's perfect, but think about it, folks. If you can get a hit 3 times out of 10 in the major leagues, here you go, Daniel. Right on time, Daniel. If you can get a hit 3 times in the major leagues out of 10, you're going to make millions of dollars, right? Which means 7 out of 10 times, you're going to strike out, right? Can you hit a fastball at 97 miles an hour?
If you're a professional.
Exactly. I got in that batting cage at 60 miles an hour and got, I said, don't turn this down. That was too damn fast for me. Anybody 60, 70 miles an hour? What'd you think?
It hurt your
hand. 80? Were you able to connect?
Not really.
Not really. But did you play baseball quite a bit? Yeah, okay.
It's more
being able to stand there and hope the damn thing doesn't hit you in the head. Okay. This is a story about John Merriweather and John Goodfriend. His actual name is Goodfreund. It's German, but I have a hard time saying that. And John Merriweather was considered the best bond trader on Wall Street. This is back in the 1980s. So let's see if it's not, you know, it'll take about 5 minutes, so relax. And I just want to see if you're still interested in going out into that world. It was sometime early in 1986, the first year of the decline of my firm, Solomon Brothers, our chairman, John Goodfriend, left his desk at the head of the trading floor and went for a walk. At any given moment on the trading floor, billions of dollars were being risked by bond traders. Goodfriend took the pulse of the place by simply wandering around it and asking questions. An eerie sixth sense guided him to wherever a crisis was unfolding. He seemed to be able to smell money being lost. He was the last person a nerve-wracked trader wanted to see. He liked to sneak up from behind and surprise you. This was fun for him, but not for you. Busy on 2 phones at once trying to stem disaster, you had no time to turn around and look. You didn't need to. You felt him. The area around you began to convulse like an epileptic ward. People were pretending to be frantically busy, at the same time staring intently at a spot directly above your head. You felt a chill in your bones that I imagine belongs to the same class of intelligence as the nervous twitch of a small furry animal at the silent approach of a grizzly bear. Often as not, your chairman just hovered quietly by you for a bit and then left. Okay, but this day he did something strange. Instead of terrifying us all, he walked a straight line to the trading desk of John Merriweather, one of the best bond traders, finest bond traders. He whispered a few words. The traders in the vicinity eavesdropped. What Goodfriend said has become a legend at Solomon Brothers and a visceral part of its corporate identity. He said, one hand, $1 million, no tears. One hand, $1 million, no tears. Merriweather grabbed the meaning instantly. The King of Wall Street, as Business Week had dubbed Goodfriend, wanted to play a single hand of a game called Liar's Poker for $1 million. He played the game most afternoons with Merriweather and his 6 bond traders who worked for Merriweather and was usually skinned alive. Some traders said Goodfriend was heavily outmatched. Others just said he was losing suited his purpose. But the peculiar feature was this challenge was the size of the stake. Normally, the bets never exceeded a few $100s. Now, you have to remember, in New York, lunch is $100, right? So a few $100s is not the same as it is here, but still a lot of money. But $1 million was unheard of. The final two words of his challenge, no tears, meant that the loser was expected to suffer a great deal of pain, but wasn't entitled to whine, bitch, or moan about it. He'd just have to hunker down and keep his poverty to himself. But why, you might ask, if you were anyone other than the King of Wall Street, why would you do it in the first place? And why would you challenge Meriwether instead of some lesser bond trader? It seemed an act of sheer lunacy. Meriwether was the king of the game, the liar's poker champion of the Solomon Brothers trading floor. Okay, now, made hundreds of millions of dollars, spell over traders, God was always the outsider, team seemed to agree, loved to trade. Now, what is liar's poker? Anybody know what it is or heard about it? No, it's not that. Okay. The liar's poker is a game where everybody takes a dollar bill out of their wallet, or whatever, $20 bill, whatever. Each player attempts to fool the others about the serial numbers printed on the face of his dollar bill and all the other dollar bills in the group. So you might have anywhere from 2 to 6 people. So you start. The first person starts. Okay. Once the first person starts, the game moves clockwise. So the first player might say 3 sixes. And what that means is that there are at least 3 sixes in his bill out of 40 numbers on the serial number and everybody else's bills. So obviously he doesn't know what's going on in the other people's bills. You with me? Understand? Okay. The player to the left can do one of two things. He can bid higher, and he could say 4 sixes or 3 sevens. Or he can challenge. He could say, nope, BS, I don't think there's 3 sixes. The bidding escalates until all other players agree to challenge a single player's bid. Then and only then do the players reveal their serial numbers and determine who is bluffing whom. In the midst of all this, the mind of a good player spins with probabilities. What is the statistical likelihood of there being 3 sixes within a batch of, say, 40 randomly generated numbers? For a great player, however, the math is the easy part. The great players have to learn how to read the faces of the other players. The complexity arises when all the players know how to bluff and double bluff. The game has some of the same feeling of the trading, just as jousting has the same feeling of war. The question a liar's poker player asks himself are, up to a point, the same question a bond trader asks himself. Is this a smart risk? Do I feel lucky? How cunning is my opponent? Does he have any idea what he's doing? And if not, how do I exploit his ignorance? If he bids high, is he bluffing? Or does he actually have 4 sixes? Is he trying to induce me to make a foolish bid? Or does he actually have the 4 or the 5 of a kind? Each player seeks weaknesses, predictability, and patterns in the others and tries to avoid it in himself. The bond traders of Goldman Sachs, First Boston, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, and other Wall Street firms all played some version of liar's poker, but the place where the stakes ran the highest, thanks to John Meriwether, was the trading floor of Solomon Brothers. The code of the liar's poker's player was something like the code of the gunslinger. It required a trader to accept all challenges. Because of the code, which was his code, Meriwether felt obliged to play. But he knew it was stupid. For him, there was no upside. If he won, he upset good friend, his boss. No good came of this. But if he lost, he was out of pocket $1 million. That was worse than upsetting the boss. Although Meriwether was by far the better player of the game, in a single hand, anything could happen. Remember? Standard deviation, anything could happen. He could get 7 sevens. So luck could very well determine the outcome. Meriwether spent his entire day avoiding dumb bets, and he wasn't about to accept this one. No, John, he said. If we're going to play for that kind of money, I'd rather play for real money. $10 million, one hand, no tears. Yes, exactly. $10 million! It was a moment for all players to savor. Meriwether was playing liar's poker before the game even started. He was bluffing, of course. Goodfreud considered the counterproposal. It would have been just like him to accept. Merely to entertain the thought was a luxury that must have pleased him well. It was good to be rich. On the other hand, $10 million was, and still is, a lot of money. If good friend lost, he'd only have $30 million or so left. His wife, Susan, was spending the better part of $15 million redecorating their Manhattan apartment. Meriwether knew that. And as good friend was the boss, he clearly wasn't bound by the Meriwether Code. Who knows? Maybe he didn't even know the Meriwether Code. Maybe the whole point of his challenge was to judge Meriwether's response. Even good friend had to marvel at the king in action. So Meriwether declined. In fact, he smiled his own brand of forced smile and said, "You're crazy." "No," thought Meriwether and all the bond traders on the Solomon Brothers trading floor. "Just very, very good." So are you ready to go up against John Meriwether?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then you're in the wrong place. Because I ain't getting in that room with him. I'm going to do what the women do, the little the singles, okay? What do you think of that story? Like that story?
Yeah,
I love that story. And this is an excellent book. It's on the bibliography that I'll show you later on. It's a little dated because most of the stories are from the mid to later 20th century. But it just talks about all the different types of people who are in the industry. The guy's name is Charles Ellis, an excellent writer, excellent writer. He wrote the book Winning the Loser's Game. And he also wrote the wonderful article called The Loser's Game. We'll discuss that later on. So, what is a realistic rate of return for me? After you have taken this course, you will have a strong knowledge of the most popular forms of investment. Stocks, bonds, cash, mutual funds. You will also know what levels of return and what levels of risk you should reasonably expect to receive. And if you are a patient, long-term investor, I believe it is realistic to expect 10, 8, 9, 10%. I'm certainly working on it myself. And even after 2008, I'm still in the game. Of course, as we will reiterate time and time again, there are no guarantees. All right. Is 9 or 10% good enough?
Yes.
It turns out the answer to this question is yes. If you start early, if you are patient and consistent, if you don't get cocky or greedy, if you don't chase after every next big thing that comes along, and most importantly, you don't panic when the market swoons. Because it's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's been happening for every 10, 20, 30 years since capitalism began. It's going to continue to happen until we come up with some better system. And I don't know when that's going to happen. The trick is to take advantage of the time value of money, also called the compound annual rate of return. Now, we will not do this in class. The handouts, the worksheets are on the website, the answer keys, the commentaries. You don't have to do them. I'm not going to ask you to do them. We do them in the 121 class. But we learn how to calculate the future value of a single payment or a stream of investment. What we're going to learn how to do later on is go the other way. We're going to learn how to look at the future and bring it back to the present. It's called the present value. And it's not for several weeks, so relax. But if you want to, go ahead on the website. Some of you will look very familiar. Remember Ben and Eileen?
Yeah.
Ben, Eileen, look very familiar. So we're not going to do the future value exercises. But one last comment on risk versus return. Here is one of Briano's secret tips. Avoid large losses. Say you had $100. And investment A, the first year, 85%.
Nice.
Investment B? But the second year, investment A loses 50%, where investment B goes up 9%. Which one do you want? How many want A? How many want A? How many want B? Come on, you have to be right. It's not testing you. How many want A? How many want B? Why do you want A? Because you're still up 30%, right?
Yeah.
Wrong. The number's up and the number's down don't work the same. After the first year, we got $185 for investment A, $110 for investment B. After the second year, we now have $92. Going down is a whole lot worse than going up. Investment B. And you know what happened? In 1999, the NASDAQ went up 85%. The NASDAQ is where most of the technology companies are. And then over the course of the next 2.5 years, it went down 80%. Ouch. Ouch, ouch, ouch. So, now before we embark on the process of identifying and familiarizing ourselves with the longer-term, higher-yielding investments, let us learn how and where to park our money using short-term investments. And that will be the presentation on Tuesday. We will look at short-term investments. But wait a second, one more time. The greater the variance in standard deviation of the average annual return of investment, the greater the risk, the more volatile, the lesser the risk, the less volatile. There's no correlation, no relationship, or standard what? I always hate these statistics. More standard deviation, more volatility, the greater the risk as measured by them, but as we said, it's an imperfect measurement. So don't you dare get this one wrong on the exam. Okay? Greater the standard deviation? Greater the standard deviation? It's bad for my self-esteem if you get that one wrong. You understand? It's like, what are you doing? You're useless. They're paying you. You're not getting through to them. So everybody got it? When we come back on Tuesday, we will get short-term investments out of the way. They're pretty straightforward. And then discuss where we go from there. So order the book. Go to the library. Read the first chapter. It's excellent. Third chapter, stay away. If you get yes, question.
What's the name of the book?
What's the name of the book? It's on the website. If you go to my website, there it is. Oh, this one. This is called Wall Street People. And it's on the bibliography, I'll tell you. Okay, so you got plenty of time to study this weekend. There's no football. Nothing to worry about this weekend. No. Okay. See you. No, it's not due for 3 weeks. See you on Tuesday. If you want to crash or you came in late, come see me.